And speaking of mysteries and difficult questions, we now have two of our veteran specialists on Graham Greene are going to address one of the murkier questions at the end of his life. As you can see, the Graham Greene and Anthony Burgess controversy. Crana Mansfield at the top for many years at the University of Manchester, and she's written a novel from the perspective of Fuang in The Quiet American. And Mike is, as perhaps you know, the six and a half time director of the festival, as his last effort got interrupted by history. And he's the author with John Wise of the great bibliography, and he edits a sort of newsletter. So we're very happy to have both of them. Tell us what happened.
Paul, am I okay if I move a little bit further? I'm just aware I'm probably cutting people off. Huh? Out the door somewhere. Thank you, Paul, for those kind words. Thank you. So just excuse me, this bit of housekeeping, but I'll do something which, given my clumsiness, is a bit dangerous. But does that work for everyone? Can everyone see past me now? Am I okay here? Because we're going to be a long way away from each other. But we want you to be able to see the screen. Okay. Just talk among yourself. Okay, I'm to start, I think. Graham Greene died in April 1991, and the team at the BBC Arts programme Arena soon got to work on what turned out to be a three-part documentary on his life and work. The result was broadcast in January 1993. And one of the talking heads interviewed for that programme was Anthony Burgess, a contemporary writer who had known Greene for over 30 years, had met him and indeed lived close by him in the south of France, reviewed his books and spoken about him in interviews. So here was Burgess's chance to say what he thought about Greene as a writer, as a fellow Catholic, and as a man. Burgess appears throughout the programme 8 times in all, and if you put them together, he talks for about 4 minutes of edited material. And now here, very expertly edited by Paul, is what Burgess had to say.
I've read all his work time and time again. I find him immensely readable, but finally I've come to the conclusion that he's not a great novelist, for the simple reason that he doesn't really become engaged with his subject. He's lacking in certain human qualities. Sometimes we have the feeling that Greene could have been a great novelist, but opted to be a good and popular one. And this in itself may be considered a sin. I think if you look at the very early novels, like, you know, England Made Me, it's a battlefield, there's an experimental quality. It's as though he's trying to extend the bounds of fiction, but then he decides not to. Let's stick to the more popular form. Let's make money out of it. Let's be popular. What struck me about Greene when he began to write genuinely Catholic novels was that he was using the materials of Catholic theology for sensational effects, and I think this began with Brighton Rock, where Greene presents, in effect, in my view, a totally untenable thesis. Two systems of conduct. On the one hand, you have right and wrong, and the other, you have good and evil. And in a sense, it's better to be evil than it is to be right. This young gangster, Pinky, is thoroughly evil. He says, improbably, you know, credo in unum satanum, I believe in one devil. And Greene always maintained that there was some virtue in evil, because evil rested on a kind of eternal level, whereas right and wrong were always changing. In a sense, he was right. but not altogether right. Evil is still a pretty bad thing. The love in it is purely sexual. A man has to commit adultery. It doesn't seem possible for Green to imagine that a man can love a woman without getting into bed with her. And, of course, Green is in love with this concept that possibly the sinner may be a saint. I think in Green's novel, theology is a substitute for psychology. Look closely at the characters, and you don't find any really human psychology working, but you do find that theology is fitting into the place where psychology should be. I think it's true of all the novels. It's very cold writes in a curious way. I think he became much more irate, much more angry in old age, living very sparsely, very parsimoniously, drinking, always drinking, but stripped himself down to a total lack of opulence. You know, this was not the situation of the distinguished writer at all, but there he was. Happy, he said he was happy, reading, going to mass occasionally, but living in sin. He was able to reconcile these things, which I personally couldn't do. But I think he wanted to create an image, you know, the idea that the great man jetting around the world, going to the most dangerous spots in the world, and holding to a kind of fundamental truth in the face of political lies. He believed that there was a connection between communism and Catholicism, that both were concerned with building the just society. And I think in The Comedians, one of his characters says, you know, both Catholicism and communism have blood on their hands, but they do not have water like Pilate. See, one of these epigrammatic statements, which are supposed to be fairly profound, but don't really yield very much. He was on very dangerous ground, I think, politically. Trouble with him, especially in his later years, was that he became very pontifical about the faith, as though he was the sole repository of its truth. You know, God may not exist, you know, and you're supposed to accept that as though it's from the Vatican itself. Hell probably does not exist. I mean, how does he know? His own attitude to Catholicism never really squared up with the official attitude. Very, very, very far indeed from the Vatican's view of Catholicism. But he got away with it because he was a distinguished writer.
Well, sorry about this slight out of syncness there, but you get the general idea. When you splice together Burgess's words like that, as Paul did for us, it is striking how critical Burgess's comments actually were, with a great deal that is personal about Green himself. And even when you get an appreciative comment like immensely readable, it's qualified in some way. He doesn't really become engaged with this subject. The background to that, in fact, is that there was friction between the two men, between Green and Burgess, which continued over years, culminating in a very public falling out in 1988. And what we aim to do in our joint talk is to look first a little at Burgess's life to fill in some of that background for us, and then to go on to describe, and we hope analyse, quite why Burgess and Green did end up in what was billed as literary giants in war of words.
So, John Burgess Wilson was born in Harperhay, Manchester, on the 25th of February 1917, into a working-class Catholic family. His father, Joseph Wilson, played the piano in music halls before taking a job as a cashier at Swift's Beef Market in Manchester. John's mother and only sister, Muriel, died in the influenza epidemic of 1918. The loss of his mother had a profound effect on his life and his literary work. When he was 5 years old, his father married a publican, Margaret Dwyer, and the family lived above a pub, the Golden Eagle, on Lodge Street in the Miles Platting area of Manchester. John greatly disliked his stepmother, depicting her in his fiction as an earwax-picking sloven. Actually, hilarious descriptions of this woman, but not at all kind. By 1928, the family moved to Mosside, where John was to write his earliest published poems and short stories. He was educated at Xaverian College and the University of Manchester, where he studied English under professors L.C. Knights and H.B. Charlton, whom he liked to call H.B. Charlatan. The building in which he studied is right across the road from the Church of the Holy Name, the Catholic Church. Some of you will recognise it. Chandina, you probably know. It's right across from the Arts Building on Oxford Road in Manchester, for those of you who know Manchester. And John went into this church to speak to a priest about his doubt of his faith when he was 16 years old. And he expected some sympathy and possibly some encouragement. What he got was not unlike what happened to Stephen Dedalus in A Portrait of an Artist, in James Joyce's novel. Namely, he got an angry rebuke with threats of burning in everlasting torment. And consequently, from then on, John was, as he described himself, a renegade from his faith. At university, he met the lively, intelligent woman who would become his first wife, Luella or Lynn Jones. He graduated with a degree in English literature in 1940, and he and Lynn married in 1942 in Bournemouth while he was the musical director of an army dance band. He had inherited his father's musical gift, and he became a very accomplished musician. He served in the Royal Army Medical Corps and the Army Educational Corps between 1940 and 1946. From 1943 onwards, he was stationed in Gibraltar, where he taught a course entitled The British Way and Purpose to the troops. While he was away, Lynn was assaulted by GIs, possibly miscarried, and certainly suffered a long-term gynecological disorder as a result. Why I say possibly is that you'll hear later that Burgess gave lots of interviews and consequently lots of different accounts of various events And so you have to pick which you think was most likely the accurate one. She drank. He drank. They went to Malaya, where she drank even more, and apparently had sex with numerous people, sometimes within his hearing, while he taught at a variety of English schools and battled with headmasters as he had earlier battled with his superior officers in the army. In 1956, his first novel, drawing on his colonial experience in Malaya, Time for a Tiger, was published under the pseudonym Anthony Burgess, as somebody working for the Colonial Office as a teacher. He was not allowed to use his own name. And so the middle name, which was his mother's maiden name, he assumed as his writer's name. So Lynn and he moved from Malaya to Brunei, but late in 1959, he collapsed in the classroom. He was discharged from the British Colonial Service and flown back to England with a mysterious illness, which might or might not have been a brain tumour. So Burgess, as we can now call him, began to write prolifically in order to provide for his prospective widow. Graham Greene and Anthony Burgess first met in London in the autumn of 1957, so that's a few years before Burgess's dramatic collapse. He brought Greene. The reason he met up with Greene was that he went to Greene's flat in the Albany and brought him some Chinese silk shirts, a gift from their mutual friend Trevor Wilson, a British diplomat in the Far East. There is a disputed story that opium pellets had been sewn into the cuffs of the shirts, and that Burgess had unwittingly acted as Greene's drug mule. More about that a little later. At that first meeting in 1957, we have here Greene, a world-famous writer, already nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature, and Burgess, a teacher and an education officer in Malaya, with a single published book to his credit. As he wrote, Burgess, much later, in 1987, of Greene's attitude towards him in that first meeting: "I was evidently not to be taken as a professional novelist, rather as a colonial civil servant who had had the luck to find excellent fictional material in the course of his duties. And I was an amateur." In the coming decades, Burgess became a major figure on the Western literary scene, but the relationship always seems to have been one of Greene's literary predominance. Burgess was always playing catch-up to the grand old man of English literature. The biographer of Greene, Norman Sherry, comments on the relationship that gradually developed between the two writers. "It was a friendship based on Greene as king and Burgess as a rather fearful courtier, a lower level official."
And I think we've got an image of Time for a Tiger as well. And that's it, the first novel.
Dedicated to Graham Greene.
Yeah.
Courtesy of the Anthony Burgess International Foundation, which is based in Manchester.
Picking up on Greene's quote from Sherry there, it may be that even Sherry's use of the word friendship between the two men is actually putting things too strongly. Burgess's biographer Andrew Biswell suggests that Burgess was writing to Greene regularly by 1961. But if so, few of their letters have survived. Richard Greene suggests that this was because they were destroyed after their row in 1988, which we're coming on to, and that may be the case. However, a letter Burgess wrote in 1971 in reply to one from Greene includes this line: "How delightful to hear from you again after all this time." And Sherry concludes that there'd actually been a 10-year gap in their correspondence. And as late as 1979, Greene was writing a letter to Burgess which began, quote, "Dear Burgess," or "Can I say Anthony?" or "Should I say Tony?" Now, that hardly suggests regular correspondence during the 1960s and 70s, and certainly not any closeness between the two men. By Burgess's own account, after 1957, the two did not meet again until after 1975, when Burgess came to live in Monaco and Greene lived in Antibes. In fact, it seems they didn't meet again until 1979, and then again in 1980, when Burgess came to interview Greene for a newspaper article, about which more in a moment. As Richard Greene says, they were, quote, two authors who had never been on intimate terms. And in Burgess's own words, they had a vague relationship.
Burgess did not die of a brain tumour. Either it was successfully treated, or, and Andrew Biswell, the biographer, good book this, do get it, credits this as a possibility. Burgess, simply tired of teaching and the strains of colonial life, so lay down in the classroom in front of all his students and refused to get up.
We could try that.
I think we've all been tempted. By the late 1950s onwards, Burgess was regularly reviewing Green's works for newspapers and magazines, and he wrote journal articles about his work. His written reviews were always enthusiastic, flattering the work of a great admirer. In 1979, for instance, his review of The Human Factor commented that the novel was, quote, as fine a novel as he has ever written, concise, ironic, acutely observant of contemporary life, funny, shocking, above all, compassionate. He added, if we accept the Secret Service novel as a genre, Green must be acknowledged its master. He is too big, however, to be approached in terms of genre, unless, that is, Hamlet is a murder story and Moby Dick a rattling good yarn of the sea. So in such reviews, Burgess always chose to be supportive of his fellow writers, and that's reflected in what he wrote about Green. But there's more to it than that in the case of his writings about Green. Burgess chose the publisher Heinemann precisely to follow in Graham Greene's footsteps, and he dedicated his 1961 novel Devil of a State to Green, with Green's permission. Burgess signed off his letter to Green in 1971, as always, your most devoted admirer. Anthony Burgess was clearly a big Green fan, but that did not prevent him from sometimes being critical of his work. In a BBC radio interview in 1973, Burgess spoke of, quote, Graham Greene, whom I love as a man and a writer this side of idolatry, end of quote, but also commented on his latest novel, The Honorary Consul. I do feel it comes very, very close to self-parody, and agreed with the interviewer that the book showed a falling off in Green's descriptive powers, adding, I felt that some of the images were very, very false.
Well, in the 1960s and 70s, there were issues emerging on which Burgess and Green disagreed, sometimes in public. In 1965, for instance, the two writers took opposite sides on the issue of whether Ford Madox Ford, The Last Post, should be included in the Bodley Head edition of Parade's End. Green was strongly against that, Burgess was in favour. And the issue was still simmering as late as 1975, when Green wrote to the press defending the novel's exclusion from the series against Burgess's complaints. Then in that same year, 1975, Burgess wrote an article in which he referred to Green as a Jansenist. I'm not a theologian, but a very quick bit of theology here. Jansenism was a Catholic heresy which stated that only a certain proportion of humanity was predestined to be saved, part of a rather exclusive club, making Jansenism a sort of Catholic Calvinism. The Orthodox Catholic doctrine was and is that humans freely assent or refuse God's gift of grace, and that Jansenism is wrong in denying the role of free will in that acceptance and use of grace. Green took exception to being labelled a Jansenist, and he wrote to the tablet, quote, "I ought not to complain about being called a Jansenist by the amiable Mr. Burgess, since it has been doubted whether even Jansenius himself was a Jansenist. Mr. Burgess, cradle Catholic though he is, or perhaps because he is, seems rather wobbly in his theology, or he would realise that my novels, which cast doubt on the doctrine of damnation, are tinged with the very opposite of Jansenism, with what he might well consider to be the damnable doctrine of hope." End of quotation. But the arguments between Green and Burgess's fellow Catholics rumbled on, as we're going to see.
Anthony Burgess penned a 3,000-word article on Green for The Observer in 1980, based on an interview in Antibes. Norman Sherry suggests that the estrangement between the two started there. Sherry quotes bits of the interview to suggest that Burgess often interrupted Green's answers to make some smart statement of his own. Quoting Sherry, "determined to show how very clever he could be, a bright-eyed sixth former showing off his erudition and at the same time seeking Green's admiration for his inventive answers." Sherry concludes, "basically, I think he found Burgess boorish."
Green reacted to that 1980 interview in two ways. Sherry quotes Green as saying that in the interview, Burgess had talked more than he had, an accusation Burgess responded to by commenting,
"This seems to be true, but it was you I talked about."
So that's one reaction. Then in an interview in Penthouse in 1982, Green told Duncan Fallowell, the journalist, he, Burgess, came across and interviewed me for The Observer. "He put words into my mouth which I had to look up in a dictionary to see what they meant." It's worth mentioning in that context that Burgess didn't use a tape recorder at the interview, but later wrote that he sent Green the text of the resultant article and got Green's approval for it. The idea that Burgess had made things up about what Green had said and used incomprehensibly long words in the process was a charge Burgess read and later denied. Well, in that Penthouse interview in 1982, Green also again refuted Burgess's claim that he was theologically a Jansenist, and again he claimed to know more theology than Burgess. But once more, he tried to keep the tone light by commenting, "he amuses me." The same tendency to swat Burgess away like a fly came in the same year over the continuing dispute over Ford Madox Ford, when Green in The Observer called Burgess, quote, "the best knockabout comedian in contemporary English criticism." In 1983, we get further insight into Green's attitude towards Burgess in a letter he wrote to Richard Ingrams, editor of the Private Eye magazine. Ingrams had sent Green a copy of the newly published Oxford Book of Sudes, shown here, a book which lampooned the intellectually pretentious Sudes. The book included excerpts from Burgess's writing. And in his letter, Green declared himself, quote, "delighted by the exposure of poor Burgess." The word poor here, an interesting combination of condescension and perhaps some sympathy. More public was Green's appearance at an event in London in February 1984. The Book Marketing Council in the UK had produced a list of 30 novels generated by three literary luminaries, and Burgess had responded to that list by producing a rival list of 99 titles. Well, in a speech at the Best Novels event, Green in turn listed 10 novels by his favourite authors and took a swipe at Burgess, commenting that Burgess's list was large but still failed to include our greatest comic writer, P.G. Wodehouse. Green described Burgess as an avid but undiscriminating reader. The speech contained several gentle jibes at Burgess, and Green seemed delighted to relate that two of his own 10 chosen novels did not appear anywhere on Burgess's vastly more extensive list of 99. That speech was Green's first in Britain for 15 years, and inevitably it attracted quite a lot of press attention. Despite Green's attempt to pass the event off as a harmless joke, the Times described his speech as having attacked his fellow author. If attack it was, it certainly came to Burgess's attention.
The explosion in the relationship came in June 1988, following public comments by Burgess on Green. An interview by Pierre Asseline for the French magazine Lire included these comments. Asseline: "Is jealousy a widespread sentiment amongst writers?" Burgess replied, "I readily believe that. As for my neighbour on the Côte d'Azur, Graham Greene, who lives in Antibes, he has become very bizarre. He has no friends. He writes letters every day to Kim Philby, the British spy refuged in Moscow. And he spreads himself around in a funny manner on my account in the British newspapers. He pretends that I have attributed imaginary remarks to him by reporting one of our conversations on a book, which is false, that he had to look up my words in a dictionary, which is also false, that I read a lot, but without discrimination. Not very friendly at all." These answers clearly imply that Burgess believed Green was jealous of him. His listing of grievances against Green is also telling. Burgess is going public on resentments that perhaps have been long building up. The published interview then continued. Asseline asked, "Why is Green like that?" Burgess answered, "He's a convert, whereas I'm a Catholic from birth. All of the difference lies there. He doesn't realise that Catholicism isn't just a religion, but a familial culture. What's more, I am half Irish. In general, in England, the faith is Irish. It's the Irish who've maintained it. This situation displeases the grand writers like Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh. It forces them to pray in the churches with Italian workers or Italian boys. Not very aristocratic at all. Socially unacceptable." Here is Burgess reversing Green's one-upmanship on his Catholic faith, a counter to Green's claim that as a convert he has a better grasp of theology than Burgess. And there is an edge of resentment evident towards Green in his reference to grand writers forced to mix with the hoi polloi. Finally, in the Lear interview, Burgess declared himself to be offended by what he referred to as Green's living arrangements, by which he meant his relationship with Yvonne Cloetta, a married woman. Around the same time, Burgess appeared on the French TV show Apostrophes, a live weekly literary primetime talk show, one of the most watched shows on French television, attracting around 6 million regular viewers. On it, among other things, Burgess referred to Green's age.
Well, Green responded to these comments by Burgess in two letters to Burgess, both written on the same day, 13th of June, 1988. And those of you who read A Life in Letters, Richard's edited things, will realise that they're both worth quoting in full. So we'll do so. The first one of the letters from that day reads like this. My dear Anthony Burgess, I hear you've been attacking me rather severely on the French television programme Apostrophe because of my great age and in the French magazine Lear because of my friendship with my friend Kim Philby. I know how difficult it is to avoid inaccuracies when one becomes involved in journalism, but as you thought it relevant to attack me because of my age, I don't see the point. You should have checked your facts. I happen to be 83, not 86, and I trust you will safely reach that age too. In Lear, you seem to have quoted as, been quoted as writing that I've been in almost daily correspondence with Philby before his death. In fact, I received 10 letters from him in the course of nearly 20 years. You must be very naive if you believe our letters were clandestine on either side. Were you misinformed, or have you caught the common disease in journalism of dramatising at the cost of truth? Never mind. I admired your three earliest novels, and I remember with pleasure your essay on my work in your collection Urgent Copy, your article on me last May in the Sunday Telegraph, and the novel, not one of your best, which you dedicated to me. Yours, Graham Greene. Well, the second letter, sent later that same day, was a bit more stinging, and here that is. Dear Burgess, I've now received another cutting in which you claim I told you of an aggrieved husband shouting through my window, difficult as I live on the first floor. You are either a liar or you are unbalanced and should see a doctor. I prefer to think that. Graham Greene. Well, an interesting aspect of that argument between Greene and Burgess is that these two letters did not stay private. By August 1988, 2 months after that exchange, newspapers were aware of the fallout. The Sunday Express telling its readers about literary giants in war of words. It was Graham Greene who made the falling out public. He told Graham Lord of the Sunday Express about the letters and said that Burgess is just bad-tempered and unpleasant. And Nicholas Shakespeare in the Sunday Telegraph magazine was given the same story. Greene was clearly keen to make the split public and to get out his side of the story. When the content of the letters was made public, Anthony Burgess was reported as being too busy to comment. So whatever friendship there'd been between Graham Greene and Anthony Burgess, it was now very publicly ended. As Greene wrote to Brian Forbes in 1989, "He's a man I do not like, and he does not like me."
Because Greene died before Burgess, Burgess had the chance to give the last word in the quarrel, and he took it. So after Greene died in April 1991, Burgess appeared on the BBC Newsnight programme talking about how posterity would remember Greene. He also wrote a memoir and an unsigned, spiky obituary of Greene for the Daily Telegraph, which both appeared on the same day. And, as we've seen, he contributed a series of generally critical comments on Greene's writing and lifestyle to the BBC Arena trilogy of programmes about Greene, broadcast in 1993.
So what had the quarrel all been about? From Greene's point of view, it may have started with their disagreement over Ford Madox Ford, but that was a matter of differing literary judgment, not in itself sufficient cause for a complete rift. More serious was Burgess's insistence on Greene's supposed Jansenism, first written about in 1965, as we've seen, and repeated a number of times afterwards. and repeatedly and irritatedly refuted by Green himself. Here was something that could and did go beyond the simply theological, as both writers claimed the high ground of authority, one as a Catholic convert, the other as a cradle Catholic. Further, Green was always irritated by inaccuracy in the press, see this morning's talk, and wrote to newspapers many times to challenge and correct errors. In particular, he disliked being misquoted or misrepresented in interviews or articles. See Michael Mushaw's book. As he apparently thought he was in the 1980 interview with Burgess, misrepresented. In a letter in 1979, Green had gently corrected Burgess for saying in a broadcast that it was the heart of the matter which had been condemned by the Holy Office in Rome rather than the power and the glory, the real culprit. As his first letter in June 1988 shows, the one we first showed, Green was annoyed at specific things Burgess had got wrong in his interview in Lear magazine. For him, Burgess was too slipshod with his facts. Mistaking his age might be seen as a trivial matter, but not his letters to Kim Philby. After Philby's unmasking and defection in the 1960s, Green's support for and continuing relationship with Philby, a Russian agent, had come in for very heavy criticism, and Green was doubtless touchy when Burgess professed to know about the extent and nature of their relationship. Green came to the conclusion that it was not sloppiness, but deliberate invention on Burgess's part. As he wrote to the Jesuit priest Anthony Bischoff in 1989, quote, "Burgess is given to the most astonishing lies."
Just briefly, back to the account of the writers' first meeting when Burgess brought Green silk shirts from Trevor Wilson. Who could have begun the rumour that the shirts contained opium? Only three people, Graham Greene, Trevor Wilson and Anthony Burgess. Neither Wilson nor Green, both MI6 reticent, is likely to have done so. It must have been Burgess, who never let accuracy stand in the way of a good story.
Nor can Green have been enamoured with Burgess telling Lear magazine that he had no friends and that he, Green, spreads himself around in a funny manner on my account in the British newspapers. Green could easily interpret the latter as a declaration of war by Burgess, but he didn't comment on the statement in his first letter in June 1988. But it's worth remembering that in that first letter in June 88, correcting Burgess on matters of Green's age and his letter writing to Philby, Green concluded with a more conciliatory final paragraph, which, if you remember, starts, "Never mind," drawing a line under it. It was not those issues that led to Green's incandescent follow-up letter. That issue was the matter of his relationship with Yvonne Cloetta, which he worked very hard to keep in deep, discreet shadows. Someone had informed Green that Burgess had been saying in interviews, for instance with a chap called John Walsh in the Evening Standard, that Green was living with a woman whose husband walked by at night and shouted up at the window, "Crapaud! Salaud! Toad! Bastard!" As Burgess later wrote about the matter, "I was indiscreet to a reporter about the Green menage." Burgess makes it sound like an inadvertent slip, but one wonders whether it had been a deliberate provocation. Whatever the case, this was the final straw for Green, and it provoked Green into his second letter and the breaking off of his relationship with Burgess. This was not a matter he could bear to have Burgess making public and making things up about as he saw it. Green mentioned the issue to both Graham Lord and Nicholas Shakespeare when he went public about the argument. It mattered to him. Beyond these very specific grievances was a marked difference in temperament and personality between Green and Burgess. Norman Sherry quotes Green as saying about Burgess, "Clever? Yes, but in company and in interview, he was an upstart and really didn't know how to behave socially." Burgess's biographer Andrew Biswell refers to Burgess's, quote, "professional man-of-letters persona, a persistent chat show guest and tireless interviewee." This was not a persona Green adopted for himself or took to in others. In his 2006 memoir, Point to Point Navigation, Gore Vidal wrote that Green disapproved of Burgess's appearance on various European television stations to discuss his, Burgess's, books. Vidal recounts that Green apparently regarded a willingness to appear on television as something that ought to be beneath a writer's dignity. "He talks about his books," Vidal quotes an exasperated Green as saying. Green resisted almost all attempts to get him to appear on television. Yet here was a garrulous show-off, a chat show Charlie, promoting himself and otherwise opining on things and getting them wrong. Hence, in large part, Green's long-time rather condescending tone towards Burgess. "Poor Burgess. He amuses me. Words I had to look up in a dictionary. An avid but undiscriminating reader. The best knockabout comedian in contemporary English criticism." Ultimately, Green thought Burgess too pushy, too wordy, too prolix a writer, and jealous of others. As Green wrote to his friend Bill Igoe in 1989, "I liked his early books, but I thought Earthly Powers was terrible. He writes far too much. Apparently, he was wildly indignant that he hadn't got the Nobel Prize instead of William Golding and believed himself to be the top of the list." Burgess admired James Joyce, perhaps above all writers, and adopted his linguistic fireworks in some of his works, including the 1980 Earthly Powers, a work of almost 700 pages. Here was a style not appreciated by Green, who's made his name for his clear, spare prose. If Burgess thought the book might win him the Nobel Prize, so much the worse for him, Green would have thought. And if he looked around the literary world in the 1980s and saw the likes of Golding and Green more highly rated than himself, then it was easy to think that resentment and jealousy was behind some of Burgess's public comments. When Norman Sherry telephoned Graham Greene's sister Elizabeth to ask what the falling out was all about, he got the reply from Elizabeth, "It's true. It's a real battle. Graham thinks it's jealousy."
How did this all look from Anthony Burgess's side of the fence? Greene's judgments looked different from Burgess's perspective. In his 1990 memoir, You've Had Your Time, for instance, Burgess wrote, "I was pretty sure he would not care for Earthly Powers. I had elected the Joycean way, in the sense of deliberately hard words, to check an easy passage of the reader in the manner of potholes in the road, an occasional ambiguity. Green had made the popular novel of adventure his model." As for Burgess putting words in Green's mouth, which he had to look up in a dictionary, Burgess's memoir shows more resentment. He quotes Green's words and adds, "This turned me against him." And this was in relation to an event in 1980, long before the two writers' explosive public falling out. Burgess had much to say about the religious element to their split. Commenting on his 1980 interview with Green, he wrote, the imputation of Jansenism still rankled with Green. Burgess's memoir also shows resentment towards Green's claims of theological superiority. I feel that the real barrier between us was that between the cradle Catholic and the convert. One who has become a Catholic by choice is bound to feel himself superior to one who, crying at the douche and then licking the salt, is merely unwittingly baptised into it. Evelyn Waugh, despite the legend, had more charity. He was certainly the better Catholic. And in his comments on the BBC Arena trilogy in 1993, as we've seen, Burgess offered a yet keener criticism of Green's Catholic pronouncements. The trouble with him, especially in his later years, was that he became very pontifical about the faith, as though he were the sole repository of its truth. But he got away with it because he was a distinguished writer. This strong edge of resentment towards Green in his comments for the Arena programme extended to Green's personal life and his public persona. Happy? He said he was happy, reading, going to Mass occasionally, but living in sin. He was able to reconcile these things, which I personally couldn't do. But I think he wanted to create an image, the idea of the great man jetting around the world, going to the dangerous spots and holding to a kind of fundamental truth in the face of political bias. Here was Burgess going further than literary or theological matters and criticising Green's personal morality and his personal myth-making as he saw it. Finally, there was Burgess's attitude towards the development of their relationship as fellow writers. In his 1990 memoir, Burgess had this to say: "There was in him, I thought, a little of the smugness of the achieved writer, although to give him his due, there was not more of it than when I had met him first in 1957. I do not think he liked my novels." A smug Graham Greene, who did not like Burgess's novels. In 1957, when the two first met, Green was the established writer, internationally acclaimed. Burgess had just published his first novel. Over the next three decades, Burgess too became a prolific and famous novelist, screenplay writer, critic and composer, nominated, as we've heard, for the Nobel Prize in 1972. And his 1980 magnum opus, Earthly Powers, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, losing out to William Golding's Rites of Passage, the same man, if Green is to be believed, whom Burgess thought he'd lost out for the Nobel Prize in 1983. Anthony Biswell asserts that Burgess's writing was undervalued by critics and scholars in England, perhaps because he was too prolific, as Green believed, not just writing too much, but being too available, spreading himself too thinly across the media. Burgess recognised these issues about himself, and the lack of recognition rankled. When Burgess was interviewed by Jeremy Isaacs on BBC's Face to Face in 1989, Burgess remembered the sneers of the literary establishment as he made his way as a writer. "Have you written your monthly novel yet, Burgess?" Some of this rubbed off on his relationship with Green. Between 1961 and 1991, Anthony Burgess wrote at least 11 published articles and reviews on Graham Greene and his writing, and contributed numerous times to radio and television discussions on Greene. His appreciation of Greene often fell little short of sycophancy. There was no such public appreciation of Burgess's works by Greene. No admiring reviews. No supportive blurbs. Appreciative comments in interviews. Rather, there was occasional condescension, some public, some private, which no doubt got round to Burgess. So Burgess came to believe, "I do not think he liked my novels." and thought that theirs was a rather uneven relationship. Praise went just one way. This is the conclusion of Andrew Biswell, and it's difficult to disagree with it. Whether Burgess's comments on TV and radio in 1988 amounted to a deliberate declaration of war, it certainly had that effect. What to Green looked like jealousy looked to Burgess like unjust neglect. Burgess died in 1993, 2 years after Green. He left a widow, his second wife, an Italian countess, whom he married in September 1968. Lynn had died of liver failure. Surprise, surprise. Earlier that year.
So the last word can be left to a man who knew both Green and Burgess and who counted both as friends. Pierre Joannon was the Irish honorary consul in Nice. And here's what he said at the 2017 Green Festival about the split between the two men. Dating note from 1981, long before the argument between the two became public. Here are Journon's words.
In 1981, at one party, I conceived the ambitious project to reconcile Graham Greene and Anthony Burgess, both good friends of mine, who made no secret of their mutually intense dislike for each other. I have a photograph of the two expatriate British writers with me in the middle, looking like an anxious firefighter caught between a lit torch and a stick of dynamite. Unfortunately, we haven't got that picture. Oh, that we did. It would be wonderful. It all went well, though. They were polite and courteous to each other, but their reconciliation remained as elusive as the reconciliation between Unionists and Republicans in Northern Ireland. They were probably too far apart. Graham, the epitome of the Englishman, introvert, shy and self-restrained. Anthony, extrovert, proud of his Irish ancestry, always restless and talking with machine gun speed. One was an island, the other a volcano. One worshipped Henry James, the other James Joyce. Graham pretended that he could not read Burgess without the help of a dictionary. Of the author of A Clockwork Orange, Graham thought, like Disraeli of Gladstone, that he was, quote, inebriated by the exuberance of his own verbosity. Last but not least, the two men were divided by the same faith. Burgess was born a Catholic and accused Graham, the convert, of theological arrogance. For Burgess, Green was something much worse than a Protestant, a hidden Jansenist. Alas, my two friends did not bury the hatchet of war this side of the grave. I hope they have made their peace in another world.
Thank you.
Just want to thank you so much for that amazing investigation of this mysterious episode, which has defeated everyone so far. And my hat's off to you. It brings to mind a moment the day or day after Graham Greene died. I was in a car with the radio on, and on the CBC evening program, as it happens, they somehow got a hold of Burgess. And Burgess said all these negative things, and the effect on me as a reader was that it diminished Burgess rather than Greene, that he chose a bad moment to go after a recently deceased person who had achieved so much. And I'm just wondering, and that's a really good this presentation. Thank you so much for it. Does anyone have some questions?
Ready for lunch? we'll be that lunch, so, Nick.
Just wanted to say a little thing or two. Graham gave me those silk shirts, and telling me that they had come from Burgess to him from Trevor Wilson. And I could find no evidence. I should look more carefully, but there was no signs of tampering with the cuffs. They seem perfectly unlikely to have had anything inserted. And the other thing that happened was that Graham sent me an article in which Burgess wrote that he was constantly deluged with a large amount of requests for reviewing books, and the books were piling up by the thousand or something. And Graham said, why don't you give him a ring? And gave me his phone number. He obviously knew what was going to happen, but he knew how many books, and he did get like all authors' review copies and so on. So I rang Burgess, and I said, I gather that you have large quantities of review copies, and maybe I could come and buy them from you. And he said, oh, no, I've got hardly any. And it won't be worth your coming, he said.
Oh, that's very interesting. When he was a school teacher, before he actually went out to the East to teach, he taught in a Banbury grammar school. Heaven help them. well, I think he was a very good teacher, actually, but I mean, his wife's behaviour was, you know, people still remember her in the town of Banbury and refer to her as the awful Mrs. Wilson. But Burgess, rather, was already doing a lot of reviewing, and once a week would take all the review copies up to London, sell them to a bookseller, and dine well on the proceeds. That was a weekly event to go and sell the review copies at that time.
One thought comes to my mind about that Jansenism stuff. That's drivel. In The Third Man, Green specifically sends up Jansenism in the business of the crucifixes.
Yes.
There's a man who collects weird crucifixes, including the ones with the arms like this, that Jansenists liked to indicate that only a few of you are getting through, boys.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at the Green Festival, and there's a natural tendency to take Graham Greene's side against Burgess, and I hope we tried a little bit to say, well, there were two sides to this. Burgess had his own view of this. But I must say, on the Jansenism issue, I think Burgess was talking absolute nonsense. I do take side on that very specific issue. From what I've read of Graham Greene's stuff, he's the exact opposite of a Jansenist. He's not this kind of elitist theologian at all.
Yeah. Mm. Mm. Yeah. It's just, with him, it was like, if anyone's getting through, we're probably almost all getting through.
just the opposite. Yeah.
It made me reflect at this, doing this on the nature of quarrels, and I came to the conclusion that all quarrels are about hurt feelings. Whatever the apparent topic is, it's always about hurt feelings. And you know, in that sense, I think Burgess dreamed of being Green's equal and being treated as his equal, and that never happened. And I do have some sympathy for him because of that. He himself attributed a lot of his behaviour to the loss of his mother so early, and then a rather sort of a father who didn't prioritise him, let's put it that way. And so perhaps he was even seeking a father figure.
Rejected by daddy.
Yes, absolutely. Put up in the attic, actually. You know, apparently when father remarried, when John was just five, as he put it, the stepson was put up in the attic with the rubbish. I mean, you know, it wasn't an attic that had been turned into some marvellous bedroom. It was just, that's where he slept. So I think he did have a sense of needing a warmth that he sought all his life.
That's wonderful. What a high point to end our presentations on. Thank you very much, Krena and Mike. A beautiful presentation.
some of us will be going to lunch.